This is Audible.
Viridian Gate Online. Cataclysm. A lit RPG adventure. The Viridian Gate Archives, Volume 1. Written by J.A. Hunter. Narrated by Armin Taylor. 1. Beginning of the End. I took one last glance around my apartment, a tiny studio flat just under 500 square feet, which still cost me a sizable chunk of change every month. It didn't help that the cost of living had skyrocketed over the past few years while my meager paycheck had remained rock steady, which is to say low. Being an EMT doesn't pay what it used to. Not that it's ever really been a lucrative career field. Kids flipping burgers at most fast food joints made what I did, despite the demands of the job. Working grueling shifts, saving lives, watching people die. Still, even in spite of the pay, it was good work. Fulfilling. My little slice of paradise had a small kitchen, a nearly microscopic bathroom, and a living room that doubled as my bedroom, office, dining room, and pretty much everything else. I'm something of a minimalist, I suppose. Someone less generous might say I was poor. Everything I owned was old, worn, and just this side of broken. A dented stove, a bulky white fridge that had certainly seen better days, a used brown sofa I'd picked up from Goodwill a couple of years ago. The couch was heavily stained, the cushions deeply creased and sagging. A full mattress in the same condition bordered the far wall near the door to the bathroom. The TV was nice at least. A hulking 75-inch Shintaro with a nano-crystal screen and multi-zone backlighting. My VR headset, a matte black helmet with a sleek viewing screen, sat on the floor next to the massive television. I smiled looking at it. Lots of good memories. For a moment, I stood there staring, swaying slightly on my feet. I frowned, trying to decide what to do next. As an EMT, I know what shock looks like, and I had it. But there wasn't anything I could do. I briefly considered going around my apartment and unplugging the appliances just to make sure the place didn't catch fire and burn to the ground. No point in that, though. A house fire was the least of my concerns at this point. So, instead, I shrugged numbly, readjusted my bathrobe, shuffled over to the cramped kitchen and poured myself a cup of day-old Joe, strong enough to knock teeth out. The coffee was tepid at best, so I stuck the mug in the barely serviceable microwave, hit the auto start, and headed over to the front door. The only door. The only way in or out save the windows, but I was four stories up, so that wasn't a huge concern. I checked the lock for what was probably the 100th time. Still shut nice and tight. The deadbolt was engaged, the hanging chain in place. Then I rechecked the shoddy wooden chair I'd jammed up under the knob, in case someone decided the lock wasn't enough of a deterrent. That was fine, too. The microwave sounded, beep, 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 letting me know my formerly lukewarm coffee was ready to go. I retrieved my cup, now steaming, took a few tentative sips, and headed over to the far window overlooking the street below. I didn't open the blinds. Didn't want anyone to see my apartment was occupied, since that might mark me as a target, but instead peeked through one of the plastic slats. A quick gander. It was getting dark and the streetlights were starting to kick on. Not that the streetlights needed to be on, what with the fires raging all over the city. Sooty orange and yellow light littered the skyline. Plumes of smoke drifting, rising, visible even against the darkening sky. A man in a hockey mask strode by on the street below, a pump-action shotgun clutched in his hands, a bag of looted toilet paper slung across his back in a duffel bag. The strobing lights of an empty police cruiser washed over him in splashes of red and blue. Toilet paper. His prize loot is toilet paper. Maybe the world deserves to die. I shook my head, then took another sip of coffee. letting the bitter liquid wash down my throat and hit my belly with a surge of delicious warmth and caffeine. I turned away from the window and fixed my gaze on the brand new, state-of-the-art next-gen VR capsule, a coffin of glossy black plastic and sleek chrome. Really, it looked more like a high-tech suntanning bed, but all things considered, it sure felt like a coffin. A host of tubes snaked away from the capsule to a hefty generator powered by a renewable hydrocell. The capsules drew far too much power to operate on the city grid, so they needed their own private source. And that generator could keep my VR capsule up and running for a solid month. Not that I needed a month. 72 hours would do it. I paused and ran a hand over the surface of the capsule, feeling the smooth plastic. Honestly, I was lucky to have the thing. A good friend of mine from college was a program developer at Osmark Tech, and she'd hooked me up big time. Of course, that had been before the news about Astraea. I tapped the surface, fingers drumming out a staccato rhythm as I took another sip of coffee. Almost time. I brought the cup away and realized my hand was trembling. Yep, almost time. But not yet. I still had a little longer. Long enough to finish my Joe. It'd be the last cup of coffee I ever have. So, I figured I should really enjoy it. I turned, refusing to look at the capsule, feeling a wave of guilt rise from my gut and claw its way upwards. I shoved the feeling away and ambled over to the couch, plopping down on the well-worn cushions just like I had a million times before. Just survivor's guilt, I reminded myself. There was no reason to feel that way. I hadn't done anything wrong. This was the end, and I needed to do what I could for me. I didn't have a girlfriend. My parents were across the country, and with air services shut down, they'd never make it out here. Not in time for it to matter. We'd already interfaced and said our goodbyes. I took another swig and glanced down, realizing my cup was already half empty. I swirled the mug, watching the black liquid dance. Better make it last. Sophia, I said.
Yes, Jack, how can I help you?
The voice, polite, vaguely British and female, resounded from a small black speaker shaped like a hockey puck attached to the side of the television. Sophia was a limited AI controller, an automation system that ran my home. Turn up the thermostat to 72 and please put on Cartoon Network.
Of course, Jack. My pleasure.
The heat kicked on a second later, a rush of warm air flooding in through the vents while the TV blinked to brilliant life.
They had classic reruns on.
Courage the Cowardly Dog shrieked, his eyes bulging out as a talking tree spouted sage advice. I wasn't in the mood for courage. But neither did I feel motivated to look for something else, something better. Most of the stations would be covering the flaming death ball anyway, and I sure as heck didn't feel like watching any more of that circus. So I sat and watched Courage's shenanigans, chuckling tiredly as I slowly polished off my drink. Enjoyed every sip. After half an hour, though, my cup was empty, and the anxiety was coming back with a vengeance. Sophia, find me news coverage? I said reluctantly. The channel switched in a blink. Courage was replaced by a pair of news anchors, one a 40-something guy with two white teeth and well-coiffed hair, the other a cute black woman with a short bob cut and a pink blazer.
We here at Channel 9 will continue to monitor the news right up until the very end, folks, said the woman in the blazer.
A countdown timer in the corner of the screen spun merrily away. 9 days, 4 hours, and 32 minutes left until impact.
Scientists from NASA, she continued professionally, along with astronauts and researchers from the U.S. European think tank ADA, Asteroid Impact and Deflection Assessment, are working around the clock on a viable solution to either destroy or divert asteroid 213 Astraea, the 9-mile-wide chunk of rock and ice
currently predicted to land in the North Atlantic near the coast of Greenland. Although few specific details have been released about Ada's plan, our sources say the best hope we have is to nudge Astraea into the stable orbit of the moon. With that said, we are told scientists and government officials overseeing the project do not seem optimistic at the prospect. Local ARC lottery winners are being directed to rally at the Ozmark football stadium as quickly as possible. But any travelers be warned, looters are out in force and you will need credentials, two forms of identifications, and lottery vouchers to get past the guardsmen holding the stadium. All vouchers are non-transferable and are invalid without proper identification.
In other news, said the man with the well-coiffed hair, Ozmark Technologies is still accepting people at their secure facility in the Silicon Valley. Those slots are limited, however, and are filling up quickly, so if you're prepared to make the leap into Viridian Gate Online, you shouldn't delay any longer. The company is urging private citizens with access to next-gen VR capsules to stream live as soon as possible. According to our sources inside Ozmark Technologies, complete interface integration usually takes 72 hours, but apparently it can take longer. So they are advising people not to wait. For those without ARC vouchers and no plans to upload into Viridian Gate Online, the National Guard is recommending you get to a secure basement and store at least 1 gallon of water per person per day for a minimum of 5 days. Also, ensure you have any necessary life-saving medications on hand, since emergency services will likely be offline for quite some time after.
Turn it off, Sophia, I said with a wave of my hand. The TV died with a single final flash of light. Then, darkness. A preview of the world to come. One big bang, then black. I set my mug down on a stained and scratched coffee table and rubbed slick palms along the legs of my sweatpants. My hands trembled noticeably. No point putting it off any longer. There was nothing left for me to do now, and if I had any chance of surviving Astraea, it was going to be inside that capsule. I stood with a groan, went over to the next-gen VR, and reverently touched the machine, keying the manual power button on the control console. Immediately, it hummed to life, accompanied by a strobe of neon blue light the color of a bug zapper. I swallowed hard, my hands now shaking so badly I wasn't sure if I'd be able to operate the controls. Thankfully, Sophia would help with the rest. I flipped open the lid and placed a modified version of the familiar VR helmet on my head before carefully lowering myself onto the stiff memory foam mattress lining the capsule's interior. The lid automatically closed, leaving me in a cramped space filled with a pulsing light. My heart labored in my chest, thumping against my ribs, beating a million miles a minute. At this rate, I'd have a coronary, which would put me down long before that stupid meteor ever got here. No, I'll be fine. All I needed to do now was give Sophia the command, tell her to initiate Viridian Gate Online, and that would be that. Except, I couldn't make my lips form the words. Once I did, I'd be committed, and I might die. There was one thing they weren't telling people on the news. 1 in 6 who attempted full integration died during the process, and those that did survive would live on as virtual avatars in a virtual world. Was that really even living? I didn't know. I also didn't know if I had the guts to pull the trigger. This was like playing Russian roulette. I shuddered, shivered. My brow broke out in claustrophobic sweat. Yeah, this process might kill me. Might, I reminded myself. When Astraea hit, though, I'd be 100% dead. No question in my mind about that. Sophia, I said, voice quavering. Please run Viridian Gate Online.
Of course, Jack, she replied calmly. Please lie as still as possible.
The machine let out a click-buzz, the lid locking mechanism, followed by the whoosh, whoosh, whoosh of a whirling MRI. Abruptly, everything went black as the VR headset engaged, but the black was soon replaced by a white loading screen. A video popped up in front of me, filling my vision, featuring a man with shaggy hair and wire-rimmed glasses, wearing black slacks and a dark navy turtleneck.
Hello, I'm the CEO of Osmark Technologies, Robert Osmark, and I'd like to personally welcome you to Viridian Gate Online, he said. The most advanced full immersion video game in the world. Viridian Gate Online is truly the first of its kind, and that's not the typical hyperbolic language so cavalierly tossed around in tech circles. No, I can assure you, I truly mean this is the first of its kind. Our revolutionary work with massive memristive neuromorphic computing systems has created a paradigm shift in AI technologies, and the result is an experience second to none. Moreover, through Osmark's patented next-gen VR capsule, you will experience a whole new world as though you were there in the flesh. Even the pain is real.
There was a pause. Robert froze with a stupid grin on his face.
Patch 1.3 update announcement, Sophia intoned.
The screen blinked and Robert resumed speaking.
If you are watching this, he said gravely, it means you have a very real, very hard choice to make ahead of you. The imminent arrival of Asteroid 213 Astraea has changed everything. Though it's possible, likely even, that human life will continue in some form or capacity after the asteroid's impact, many, if not all of you watching this, will die. That's a somber, hard truth, and at this stage, it's a truth which shouldn't be sugar-coated. But there is another way. A way that you might live, and I'm extending that invitation to everyone watching this. Our next-gen VR capsules work by injecting microscopic nanobots into your bloodstream. The nanobots migrate north and map out your mind in precise detail. These extraordinary mechanical marvels survey each of the major portions of your brain, the cerebrum, the cerebellum, and the brainstem, and chart each of your neural pathways, which is no small feat. They're the secret behind our system's full integration. They actually stimulate the nerves in your brain, allowing you to experience the game with lifelike sensation. The information gleaned by the nanobots is then uploaded to one of several deep Earth servers located in secure bunkers all across the globe. Truthfully, that's far more candid than I ever expected to be about how the process works. But this is the end of the world.
He offered a tired, lopsided smile.
The system is perfectly safe, under the right conditions. During our clinical trials, we discovered that if this uploading process continues for longer than 72 consecutive hours, the body shuts down and the physical brain goes into a state of catatonia. After that, without proper life support measures, the body simply dies.
He folded his hands, lips pressed into a tight line.
But that map the nanobots uploaded, he continued after a beat, will continue to exist indefinitely within the game server. And that map is, for all intents and purposes, you. It's your thoughts, emotions, experiences, personality. A digital copy of you within the game world of Viridian Gate Online. Originally, we installed neural inhibitors into all the capsules, which automatically logged players out after 6 hours of gameplay. But patch 1.3 has changed all that. The neural inhibitors have all been disabled, and after 24 hours of in-game time, the logout button will permanently disappear, leaving you stranded in the game. If you choose to upload yourself to Viridian Gate Online,
you have a chance at surviving Astraea, at least in a digital form. Now let me take a moment to address some of the concerns circulating around the internet rumor mill. First, I can personally assure everyone listening to this message that patch 1.3 is our last major update. The game is locked, and all essential functions are now being administered by the AI controllers. Second, contrary to what some fearmongers have reported online, once you are uploaded, no hacker or Ozmark Tech employee will be able to delete your profile. All permanent user profiles are immediately encrypted using asymmetric key cryptography and then circulated continuously and randomly through all our linked databases, ensuring no one person will ever be able to access your digital identity. Not even I could manage to do it. And really, this is as much for our protection as yours. We don't want a way to delete players because that's a two-edged sword, which could easily be wielded against us. No, I can assure you, once you've successfully transitioned to a digitized form, you'll be safe and secure for as long as VGO exists. With that said, I won't lie to you. This process isn't without risks. Not everyone successfully transitions. There is a 1 in 6 chance you will die during the process. 1 in 6. But for the vast majority of you, there is a 100% chance you will die if you fail to take the risk. By watching this warning, you hereby remove all liability of damages from Ozmark Technologies, its corporate owners, and its subsidiary entities. Would you still like to proceed?
His terrible question hung in the air. Heavy, like a storm cloud. Did I want to proceed? Would existing in a video game really be better than dying? Than seeing what came next? Yes, I said. Proceed. The machine kicked into overdrive, the whirling picking up in intensity. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. Traveler, boomed a hard-edged male voice. Prepare to enter Viridian Gate Online. Two. VGO. The white loading screen gave way, and, in an eye blink, I found myself standing on the rocky slope of a gigantic mountain, snow and ice underfoot, a tremendous valley stretching out before me. The sight was breathtaking, amazing. The lush forests and rolling plains below so lifelike I could have sworn I was standing high in the Rockies or maybe the Swiss Alps. A slapping wind bit at my hands and face, plastering crude, scratchy homespun garments to my body. I reached tentative fingers up to my cheek, feeling the prick of rough stubble running along my jawline. Wow. I dropped to my ass, my legs too weak to support me. The chill from the snow instantly hit me as water soaked into my threadbare pants. I scrambled back to my feet in a hurry, eager to be away from the cold. I glanced down and saw a divot in the fresh powder. Wow! This was incredible. I'd been involved in VRM MMORPGs for as long as they'd been around, but there'd never been anything like this. Never. Not even close. The graphics quality was unmatched, indistinguishable from RIL even. The frigid snow and the blades of grass poking up from below were as real as the saggy couch in my apartment. And the sensations. I could really feel here. I wasn't sure what I'd expected when I'd first heard about the next-gen VR's capsule's nerve tech features, but it hadn't been this. I could smell the fresh pine wafting from the towering spruces and sprawling evergreens dotting the mountainside around me. On a whim, I bent over and scooped up a handful of powder and took a bite. Cold, faintly flavored with ozone and cedar. The snow melted in my mouth, water trickling down my throat and hitting my belly with a cool splash.
Robert Osmark certainly hadn't been exaggerating. This was definitely a first-of-its-kind game. Still, as amazing as this was, could I live here forever? Guess I didn't have much choice at this point. That thought vanished as a semi-translucent display popped up. A hazy image of myself, an average-looking guy with sandy brown hair, a medium build, and a slightly pinched face, floated in the air. Except, I was no longer wearing my ratty old bathrobe and sweatpants. Now, I was sporting a tattered burlap-looking tunic with rough stitching, a pair of equally uncomfortable trousers held up with a length of rope, and some fur boots that weren't doing much to keep the chill out. An interface bar with a variety of options, race, build, sex, face, name, trailed down beside my floating avatar. I glanced up at race, and immediately a new options menu appeared on my right, hovering in the air like a specter. A list of available playable races. I scanned the first one, Hvitalfar. Immediately, my avatar's image changed. Sandy brown hair was replaced by platinum blonde locks, and my skin took on a golden hue while my ears elongated, slimming to narrow tips. It was still me, though, my face and body providing the underlying framework for some new and strange costume. A prompt popped up and lingered at the bottom of my vision.
Hvitalfar, Dawn Elf. The elves of the Shining Plains, also known as Hvitalfar, make excellent clerics and sorcerers. Due to their natural affinity for spellcraft and the restorative arts, they receive a 5% bonus to starting spirit. With their affection for nature and close kinship with animals, they also make admirable rangers, excelling in the shaman kits.
I immediately scrolled down, gaze landing on the next race in the list, Dokalfar. My avatar changed again, this time the skin darkening to a dusky gunmetal gray, my hair going a glossy raven's black, which looked almost blue from a certain angle. This race also had pointy ears, and I could tell they hailed from the same family as the Dawn Elves I just looked at. After a moment, a new text box appeared.
Dokalfar, Merc Elf. The Merc Elves of the Storm Marshes are a tough and often unlikable people. Many Dokalfar prefer to keep to their own kind and rarely venture outside their boggy homelands. A lifetime of living in the dangerous and predatory swamps of Eldgard make them excellently suited to be rangers. They also excel in the rogue class, particularly as assassins, sicarii, since they possess a 20% resistance to poison and disease, or as mysterious Dark Templars, the enforcers of the Shadow Pantheon.
There were several other races to choose from. The Svartalfar, short and squat, who resembled the typical dwarf and excelled in smithing, enchanting, and merchant craft. They also sported a hefty 50% increase to fire, probably on account of their forge work. Next came humanoid creatures with dark Middle Eastern features and pronounced wings jutting from their backs. They looked like living angels. The Accipiter, who could fly apparently, had a few race-restricted specialty classes, and a sizable bonus to dexterity. Two varieties of humans followed. The Imperials, vaguely Roman-looking with short, wavy hair and Mediterranean complexions, and the Wodes. The Wodes, big and blonde-headed, looked like the Germanic barbarians of ancient history. Neither of the human races had any extra racial bonus or resistances, but there was a note which read, "Humans can assume any profession or non-restricted class without penalty," which was probably a big advantage early on. Last came the Risi, a meaty-looking humanoid loaded down with thick muscle, faintly green-tinged skin, and a pronounced underbite studded with protruding fangs. Some variety of troll or ogre, if I had to guess. The Risi, more than any other race, appeared excellently suited for heavy melee combat and tanking, but I knew without hesitation I wouldn't be going that route. First, I found brawlers and fighters were great early on, but were often lacking at higher levels. And second, the most important factor, I refused to look like that monster for the rest of my life, no matter what racial bonuses might sweeten the pot. I quickly went back through my options, eliminating the Dawn Elf and the Dwarf. Being a glass cannon mage didn't suit my playstyle, and I certainly wasn't a crafter by nature.
which left the Merc Elf, the bird-winged occipiter, and the two human races. I saw a wiki icon and immediately brought up a search menu. "Look for class kits," I said.
"Certainly, Jack,"
Sophia answered, which was a pleasant surprise. Hearing her voice was a small point of comfort. Unfortunately, the search yielded a whole bunch of nothing, so I closed out and went back to my character creation screen. Usually in MMORPGs, I played as a cleric slash healer, but a mixed class like a paladin or dark paladin might serve me well in this new frontier where I didn't have a clan, didn't know the rules, and might have to go it alone for a while. I paused, rubbing at my chin. Rogues were also highly versatile for lone wolf players, so that might be an option to consider, though that certainly wasn't my preferred class. Finally, I scrolled over to the Merc Elf. That 20% poison and disease resistance was too good to pass up. Plus, superficial as it may have been, he looked badass. And the only other character I could reasonably see myself as was the Occipiter. Except, I wasn't so great with heights. So, I selected the Merc Elf. Then scrolled through the other creation features, tweaking my appearance a bit, adding some extra muscle here, opting for a short beard there, picking a few swirling tribal tattoos, before finally selecting the Create option. A new screen appeared asking me what name I'd like for my character. Jack didn't seem like an appropriate name for a high fantasy elf, but it was my name, and I was hesitant to give it up. Everything else was changing. My face, my body, my world. But I could keep my name. Or at least a variation of it. Grim_Jack was my gaming handle, so if I went with that, it would kind of be the best of both worlds. "Grim Jack," I finally said, decided.
"Are you sure you would like to create Grim Jack the Dokalfar?" came the booming baritone voice from before. "Once you create a character, you will not be able to change your racial identity or name. Please confirm."
"Yes," I said again, trepidation mounting in my stomach, not knowing what came next.
Three. Clash of Kingdoms. I waited for a beat, then two, folding my arms. I was on the verge of saying something else, maybe telling these guys to get a move on it, when music exploded around me like a thunderclap. An epic score with pounding drums, clanging cymbals, and a host of stringed instruments conjured images of noble kings and fierce battles, clashing armies, and world-shaking magic.
"The year is 1095 AIC, Anno Imperium Condite," the disembodied announcer bellowed over the music. "Dark power and the stirrings of war ride upon the winds of Eldgard, the provincial outpost of the great Viridian Empire." Something streaked across the sky, a burst of fire that reminded me all too much of the meteor and the world I was leaving behind. The streak of light disappeared, blocked from sight by a thicket of pines, then exploded back into view 100 feet away. A massive, scale-covered body with huge, pumping wings flashed across the field of view, trailing fire from crushing jaws as large as a T-Rex's. A golden eye, big as a dinner plate and slit down the middle with a slash of black, regarded me coolly for a second. Then, the creature ascended into the clouds above. Gone. The breath caught in my lungs. A dragon. A fantastical monster of scale and fangs and flame.
"Imperial legions," said the announcer, "allied with the forces of light, march from the east, bringing the natives of Eldgard to their knees through flame, magic, and steel. Bringing progress, building roads, cities, a kingdom. Civilizing the dark-natured Wodes, the swamp-dwelling Dokalfar, and the Occipiter of the far western deserts. Enlightening them in the ways of the ever-victorious Empire."
On the stretching plains below,
I watched in awe as a sprawling force of humans, elves, and Risi, men and women, all clad in gleaming metal and oiled leather, swarmed across the ground like a plague of locusts. Banners rippled in a faraway breeze while foot soldiers hauled towering catapults and other savage siege engines.
But the natives of Eldgard are not so quick to give up the old ways, to heal for foreign masters. Though the rebellion is yet small, they fight on, hour by hour, day by day.
Suddenly, I was floating, drifting high above like an eagle. The encroaching army vanished in a swirl of black smoke, and I found myself overlooking a marshy swamp filled with twisted trees and murky water. Dusky-skinned merc elves, clad in dark leathers and crudely stitched robes, fashioned swords and fletched arrows. The scene exploded in a shower of light as a flock of the bird-like accipiters cut through the air, banking hard right on outstretched wings before unleashing a volley of arrow fire on the invaders below. Then, the scene faded, shimmered, resolved. Blonde-haired woads forged armor, battle axes, and heavy maces in a roaring furnace, the sound of steel hitting steel ringing out like a battle cry.
But in the far-flung north, another threat looms, came the announcer's voice as the woad encampment vanished, giving way to a domineering peak capped with icy white. The reclusive, mountain-dwelling Svartalfar have unwittingly burrowed into the prison of a dusty and long-forgotten god, a monstrous being of true dark, eager to return to the land of mortals once more. The breach is small, but large enough for Serthrog, Demon Prince of Morzheim, to call acolytes to his cause. Imperial, rebel, light, dark, living, dead. Which side will you choose?
The towering mountain erupted in a swirl of opalescent light and violent motion, wind beating against me with gale force fury as I fell. Tumbled, end over end, arms wheeling, legs kicking, stomach rising into my throat.
This shouldn't be happening, I told myself. I shouldn't feel this way.
But the logic didn't do much to ease the fluttering in my belly. I flipped once more and caught a set of burning eyes, green and deeply malevolent, watching my meteoric descent with amusement. I smacked against cold stone with a thud, pain shooting from my back, elbows, and skull. Man, the devs had taken this whole realism angle very seriously. Maybe a little too seriously? My head began to pound with a dull throb, and I restlessly ran my hands over my stomach, impulsively searching for broken ribs. When I was finally satisfied that nothing was irreparably damaged, I pushed myself up and leaned back onto my elbows. I blinked sporadically, squinting against the dark, trying to figure out where exactly I was. What had happened? The lighting was terrible, gloomy and provided by sparse, sooty firelight. But after a few minutes, everything took on a ghostly blue tinge.
Racial ability unlocked. Night Eye.
Night Eye allows you to see even in the poorest of lighting conditions, casting the world into a blue haze.
Hvitalfar, Dawn Elves, Dokalfar, Merc Elves, and Svartalfar, Dwarves, automatically use Night Eye in dark environments. Ability type level. Racial. Passive. Level 1. Effect. 8% vision improvement at night or in poor lighting.
I read over the gained skill and smiled. That was a nice little bonus they hadn't mentioned during character creation. I dismissed the alert with a nod and resumed my scan. The ground was gritty stone, and I immediately noticed thick steel bars around me. I was in a cage. A shoddy prison cell. I gained my feet, dropped into a crouch, and stole forward, searching for the door. It didn't take me long to find the exit, but It also didn't take long to find the thick iron lock, which refused to budge an inch when I yanked at it. Well, this didn't seem like a good way to start things off. I let the lock go and pressed my face against the bars, searching for an NPC, non-player character, or any sign of what I was supposed to do. I was in a rectangular chamber in some sort of underground cavern. Formidable stalactites and stalagmites jutted from the ceiling and floor like the wicked teeth of a monstrous, slumbering beast. In the center of the room was a grisly scene that made me immediately rethink the wisdom in choosing Viridian Gate Online as an emergency life raft. A rudimentary wooden table dominated the space, and strapped to that table were bodies. Pieces of bodies, in most cases. As an EMT, I'd seen a lot of awful scenes. High-speed car wrecks were frequently stomach-churning, but I still wasn't prepared for the graphic display. Amputated limbs, strings of gray intestines, a glassy-eyed head devoid of a body. There were also other tables littered with cruel-looking tools, hooks, pliers, knives, and clamps, plus a variety of machines and contraptions that didn't look friendly. An open metal sarcophagus, outfitted with foot-long metal spikes, was particularly gruesome. I swiped the back of my hand across my forehead, wiping away the cold sweat dotting my brow. I didn't know what they had planned for me here, but it couldn't be good. I immediately turned my attention back to the lock, holding it up and giving it a thorough examination. I thought about slamming it against the bars in hopes of breaking the thing, but quickly dismissed the notion. That wouldn't work. Plus, there was a good chance it would alert whoever was running this nightmare dungeon, and I wasn't keen to meet them. Not as a noob, stuck in a cage with no weapons, no armor, and no skills. I turned back to my cramped cell, scurried over to the simple pallet of furs in the corner, and began to frantically search for a key or lockpick. The devs wouldn't start you out in a cell if there wasn't a way out. There had to be something. I pulled aside a rough blanket and tossed the furs. Something metallic clinked against the floor. A glint of light revealed the piece of bent black metal. A makeshift prison shiv, maybe? Or a lockpick. Certainly not an elegant lockpick, but that had to be its purpose. I headed back over to the lock and slipped the thin length of metal into the keyhole. I jiggled it around for a bit, pushing, prodding, rattling it this way and that. In most MMORPGs, there was an auto-assist mechanism to help with the lockpicking aspects of gameplay. I didn't get any kind of notification, however, no prompt telling me how the system worked, and I certainly didn't get an assist. After a few minutes of fruitless struggle, I pulled out the pick and slammed it against the ground in frustration. Then, I froze. The soft rustle of moving fabric caught my ear. I wasn't alone. Someone, or something, was in the room with me. Four. Cutter. I surveyed the main chamber again, but saw no one. Marching off to my right, though, were more heavy cages, identical to my own. I slipped the pick into a crude pocket on my trousers and crawled toward the source of the noise.
Hello? I called out in a harsh whisper. Is anyone there?
A blurry shape materialized from the shadows two cages over. A man, garbed in the same plain clothes I was leaning against the bars, his arms folded, a faint grin lifting the corners of his lips. A human with the wiry build of a street brawler, short blonde hair, and a strong jaw riddled with stubble.
It's harder than it looks, said the man. Lock picking, I mean. People think they can just shove a spit of metal into a lock and pop.
He snapped slim fingers.
She opens right up.
He shook his head.
It takes skill, finesse. You have to understand how the tumblers work. You have to feel the spring mechanism, have to intuit the pin placement.
He paused, examining his fingernails.
If you're interested, I could walk you through the process, show you how to get that door open.
Yeah? I replied. And what would you want for that?
What would I want?
He asked, his face a portrait of shock.
What I want is to get out. You're a Dokalfa, so I assume you see all that butchery on the table. I certainly don't want to end up like that.
I glanced at the table again, at the congealed blood and strewn body parts. What are they doing here? I asked, tearing my eyes away from the display.
Not entirely sure,
the man replied, shrugging one shoulder.
It's not good, whatever it is. There's some kind of dark priest running the show, an acolyte of Seth Rogg. At least, that's what I've been able to glean through half-heard whispers. Not exactly a friendly, talkative sort, that fellow. All I know is he's experimenting on people, trying to change them somehow. Sometimes the change takes and he lets them go. Other times...
He trailed off, then waved a hand toward the table.
I'll tell you this, though. I don't want to undergo his experimenting. So, I could show you how to open that lock in exchange for my freedom, or you could just toss me the shiv. I'll pop the lock on my cage, then come over and bust you out. Sound fair?
If I give you the pick, I said, what's to stop you from just breaking free and leaving me here to rot? He sighed and rolled his eyes. Obviously, there's nothing to stop me, except for the fact that we're both in an awful situation.
I could do that, but at my core, I'm a lover, not a fighter. Well, not a fair fighter, anyway. And it seems like we'd have a better chance escaping together than I would alone. I always say, why make an enemy when you can fashion a tool instead?
Besides, worst case scenario, I help you out, you distract the guards, and I slip away in the shadows and leave you for dead. You being free is a win all round for me. I pulled the pick from my pocket and regarded it. As much as I didn't trust the shifty man in the cell, I didn't particularly feel like taking another run at the whole lockpicking thing, even with instruction. I nodded, resolved, stuck my hand through the cell bars, and tossed him the pick. He snatched it from the air with practiced ease and immediately set to work on his cell door. He proved to have an awfully deft hand since the lock came away a second later. The guy made it look downright easy. He pushed his door open, took a tentative look around to make sure no one was coming, then beelined for my cell, setting to work without a word. My lock came away even faster than his had. I looked around my cell one last time, making sure there weren't any beginner items I was supposed to take. Nothing. Thanks, I said, pushing my way to freedom. I'm Jack, by the way. Grim Jack.
Cutter,
he said with a nod. Now how about we save the bonding thing for after we find a way out, eh? You can tell me a whole stupid life story of a pint of ale, friend, but until we make it to an inn, let's keep our minds focused on escape. Cutter took the lead, dropping into a slight crouch and stealing across the rectangular chamber, giving the table at the center a wide berth. I followed behind, mimicking the man's posture and working to keep as quiet as possible. It was hard to do, though, what with my heart pounding like a drum. There was a tunnel at the far side, a twisting thing that ran straight for a few feet before abruptly snaking right and out of view. Cutter halted at the tunnel entryway, putting up a hand, a gesture that told me to stop, to wait. He dropped to a knee and ran his finger over the floor, gaze flickering back and forth.
What are you doing?
I asked, my curiosity getting the better of me.
Traps, he muttered absentmindedly. This seems like a good place to set a containment ward, but I'm not seeing anything.
He stood and moved over to the wall, pressing himself against the stone.
Oh, I don't suppose you're the sneaky sort, are you?
He asked, glancing over his shoulder at me. If it means getting out of here in one piece, I'm absolutely the sneaky sort, I replied.
Good, good, he said with a bob of his head. Crouch a little.
He bent his legs in demonstration. And when you walk,
Move heel-toe, heel-toe. None of that tiptoeing nonsense. You want to evenly distribute your weight over your whole foot. Takes a little getting used to, but do it enough and it'll become second nature. Now, keep to the shadows, stay quiet, and walk just like me.
He turned and set off, ghosting forward on silent feet. As he moved, the shadows almost seemed to reach out to him, to embrace him, blurring the sharp lines of his body, rendering him fuzzy, indistinct. I followed, practicing the odd walk as I slipped along behind him. A prompt appeared a second later.
Skill, stealth. Stealth allows you to creep through the shadows, making you harder to detect by hostile forces. Successful attacks from stealth mode activate a backstab multiplier for additional damage. Skill type level, active, level 1. Cost, 10 stamina. Effect, stealth 7% chance to hide from enemies.
Nice. Even if I didn't end up playing as a rogue class, stealth was always a useful skill to have, especially at lower levels. That backstab multiplier could level the playing field for a relatively weak starting character. Cutter and I continued down the winding hallway, moving from one pool of inky shadow to another, avoiding the light from the flickering torches mounted at sporadic intervals. After 100 yards or so, the tunnel connected to a rough circular cavern with a pool of stagnant black water loitering at its middle. There were no torches here, but a soft crimson glow emanated from thousands of rough crystals lining the vaulted ceiling above. The chamber looked to be some sort of central hub. 2 sizable hallways, each constructed of smooth sandstone bricks, connected here. Cutter tentatively crept out toward the water, but stopped as the sound of heavy footfalls drifted into the room, coming from the sandstone tunnel dead ahead.
Five. Mercy.
Cutter glanced back at me, eyes wide, and jerked his head toward a narrow gash in the rock wall on our right. Both of us sprinted for the tight crevice, slipping in between the rocks, then went still as a group of somethings strutted into the room. As they drew closer, a caption appeared above their heads. Lesser Fiend. They were hulking creatures, 8 feet tall with blue, pebbled skin, wearing long shirts of black chainmail. Each clutched a deadly weapon. Some held towering halberds, while others carried wicked flails in claw-tipped hands. The creatures walked upright, but had inverted knees and cloven hooves, which clack, clack, clacked against the stone. I counted 6 of the things, way too many for us to fight. The lead creature paused as it entered the room, barking a harsh command in some unintelligible language, then raised a wolf-like muzzle, its black nose sniffing, sampling the air, sensing our presence. I held my breath, afraid the slightest motion might give us away. After what felt like a lifetime, though, the creature lowered its snout and shrugged beefy shoulders, false alarm, then led the rest of his squad down the other sandstone hallway, vanishing from view. I let out a ragged sigh of relief and wanted to fall over and call it quits. This game was intense. Too intense. Being in here was less like playing an RPG and more like going to a haunted house. Sure, you knew the monsters weren't real, but that didn't stop them from scaring the crap out of you. Not to mention, in here, the horror house monsters could not only scare you, they could attack you and, more importantly, hurt you.
Ready to move,
I whispered, turning toward Cutter. He was behind me, but I immediately noticed something behind him, the rough outline of a hidden door set into the wall. A new alert appeared, and the outline of the door began to glow faintly purple.
Ability. Keen sight. A passive ability allowing the observant adventurer to notice items and clues others might not see. Ability type, level. Passive, Level 1. Cost, none. Effect, chance to notice and identify hidden objects, increased by 6%.
I rubbed a hand over my jaw in thought, feeling the unfamiliar bite of facial hair. I'd always wanted a beard in real life, but I'd never been able to grow one. At least, not a good one. It always came in uneven and patchy. I dismissed the stray thought and reread the notification. Keen sight. That seemed like a handy passive ability to have in my back pocket. Though, I had to imagine most players probably acquired this skill, since it wasn't tied to race and it was awfully easy to come by. At that point, though, I'd take any freebies I could get.
Door,
I said, pointing to the wall behind the thief.
Good eye, Cutter said with an approving nod. In my experience, someone doesn't go through the trouble of installing a hidden door unless there's something worth hiding. Let's take a little look, eh?
He moved forward, hands out thrust. He lightly ran his fingers over the surface of the stone, gently prodding, exploring the nooks and crannies, carefully feeling out every dip in the wall.
Ah, there she is,
he said with satisfaction as the door clicked and retracted, pulling back, sliding into the wall. The room beyond was some sort of lab. A variety of long shelves sat against the wall, heavy laden with various test tubes and glass vials. I put them from mind, focusing instead on the corpse of a haggard old merc-elf strapped to yet another wooden experimentation table. She was rail-thin, nearly naked, and all sharp protruding bone. Her grayish skin looked as worn and frail as cheap toilet paper. She had several long scars crisscrossing her belly and arms, which had been crudely stitched up. Poor old gal. Cutter immediately rushed into the room, slinking around, presumably searching for traps, while I headed over to the body. I knew she was just an NPC, more likely a part of the scenery than anything else, but part of me felt like I should find something to cover her with so she'd have a little dignity in death. Instantly, I recoiled when her chest rose and fell, a rattling gasp escaping from her throat like the rustle of wind through barren trees. I shivered at the awful sound, and the EMT in me immediately began chattering away, demanding I check for vitals and start CPR.
Cutter! This lady is alive, I said. She's alive. We should do something. Help her.
The rogue turned from his thorough search, giving the woman a quick once-over, followed by a sniff and a sneer.
There's nothing to do for her. She's one stiff breeze away from killing Alvarez is. And even if we could help her, why would we? She's not going to bring anything to the table. She's going to be a liability to our survival and escape.